And it is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman is back tomorrow. This hour we feature acclaimed writer George Saunders with Topical Currents literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez. Saunders specializes in unique short stories, essays, novellas, even children's books. His latest story collection is titled 10th of December, a New York Times bestseller. Saunders now joins our Ariel Gonzalez, who first posed the question, why does writing realistic fiction make him so uncomfortable?
Mainly because if I conceptualize myself as writing about real stuff, then it goes a little dead. In other words, when I was younger, I thought the idea was you tried to present, hold up a mirror to the world and so on. And when I did that, there was just no zip in my prose. So it really is just a survival strategy. If I think of it that way, the prose goes dead. So I just have to give myself a little bit of permission to riff, to exaggerate, to kind of take the world and turn it up 5 or 10%. And as long as I give myself that little mental permission, I think what happens is I end up writing more realistically, in other words, more truthfully. But somehow that was just a little thing I had to give myself. I don't know why.
Well, you come from, and I say this not in any disrespectful way, a mundane background.
Yes.
You did not start off as a writer.
No.
You began as a geological engineer, and you were in that field for several years. And you were writing, if I'm not mistaken, journals for a corporation, correct?
Right. Well, there's sort of two phases. The first one, I was in Sumatra doing sort of oil exploration. And then when I came home, I started doing tech writing for a pharmaceutical company and then for an environmental company. So kind of just doing technical reports for the government and so on.
And that's just sort of living death, isn't it?
Well, it was definitely not living life. It was actually I found pleasures in it, because at that time we had just had our daughters, and my wife and I kind of went from young sort of hippie writers to parents very quickly. And I actually had a lot of fun just becoming responsible, and the work that I was doing was dull at first, but then because it was part of this larger project of having a family, I kind of found ways to enjoy it. And one of them was to say, a technical report could be understood as an aesthetic object. There are good ones and bad ones. So since you got to edit them, edit them with a lot of energy. And I found that approach drifting over into my fiction, which I was also writing at work. So I didn't find it so terrible, actually. It had its payoffs,
But you were also writing fiction at work, as you said.
Yes. Yeah.
So how were you able to keep that under the radar?
Lying and cheating. Well, you had, at that time it was, I think WordPerfect was the dominant software. And so Shift F3 would toggle the screens. So I would have the story up on one and then my work document on the other. And I sort of placed my desk to be the maximum number of paces away from the door, and so if someone was going to see me, they had to really work at it. So I would just put a story up and start working on it, and then when I got interrupted, I'd hit Shift F3 and go back. And we were billing our hours, so in an 8-hour day, I could find 20 minutes or half an hour, or sometimes at night on the bus on the way home. And actually, it was a great way to get. I'd been through an MFA program, and I think I'd gotten a little bit precious about my process, and this was a great way to just take all of that preciousness out, because you couldn't choose when you wrote, you couldn't choose the environment, you couldn't choose the duration, and if the iron was hot, you had to strike right then and there or lose it for the day. So it was actually kind of a wonderful training.
We're speaking with George Saunders, whose new book is called 10th of December. In your fiction, there is a lot of satire about corporate life, corporate America. Having come from that world, how did that influence your work?
Well, it was so pervasive that I didn't even notice it as the topic when I wrote the first book. I was only a couple months after I finished it that I went, oh my God, this book is about the last 7 years of my life, because I worked for an environmental engineering company, and a lot of what I was doing was tech writing I wouldn't quite call it spin, but you know, you're working for the client. Usually you're working for the polluter. So you present things in a very sort of delicate way. And that kind of, the distortion of language that that requires was really interesting to me. And after a while, it started to seem like a kind of poetry. You know, if somebody drops a ton of radium in a public swimming pool and you say levels of water in the swimming area were perhaps above regulated levels, you know, that there's a slight spin there. So I think it was great to work there, because whereas before that I'd been kind of a Hemingway guy, and for something to be literary, it had to be a little purple and a little elevated. Working in that environment, you saw that language is always evolving. Language is always poetry, even if it's low language, even if it's full of jargon, even if it's sort of meant to deceive. There's a kind of a poetics about it. So I found my prose getting a little new in that environment. You know, to hear someone speak with a corporate inflection became kind of beautiful to me in a certain way, and it just permeated the stories.
Because you've been compared to Mark Twain, Kurt Vonnegut, but I see Orwell in a lot of your work.
Yeah.
Because of what Orwell talked about, the corruption of language, the distortion of language for the use of immoral purposes.
Right.
And there's a story in your new collection, Exhortation, which is in the form of an email. Mm-hmm. That's sent out by someone. And again, this is the wonderful thing about your writing style. You lure us in. At first, it just seems like a normal email, just that any, you know, business guy sends out to people. But as we're reading, we start to realize these people that he's talking to, what they do, they may be torturers. Hmm. They may be, they work in this, so this room six. And in this room six, something happens. You never are specific about it,
right.
But the careful reader will figure out these are torturers. But again, it's all in the language of business or corporate,
right.
Of corporate America.
Yeah, well, that Orwell essay, Politics in the English Language, was huge for me, because it kind of was a permission giver for these things that I'd noticed when I was working in the oil fields in Asia. And when I read that essay, I thought, oh, of course, that's what it is. When language goes strange, it's and especially when it goes bad, when language becomes inefficient, or it's often hiding something, you know. A lot of my family members were salesmen, and I am very comfortable with that idea of using language to say something that you don't want to say directly. And so that piece is an example of that. And
well,
that was actually before Guantanamo, years before Guantanamo.
Yeah, exactly, because now we have it. When Cheney and other people talk about enhanced interrogation mm-hmm. techniques, and they love that term.
Right, right.
You know, we're dealing, talking about torture.
Yep.
But because they don't have the courage to call it what it is.
Right.
So they have to come up with this euphemism.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the euphemism, again, can hide the most horrible things,
Final
solution.
Well, there was a great memo a friend sent me once, and it said something like this. I'm paraphrasing, but it said, because it has been observed that the subjects react negatively upon exposure to sunlight, it is hereby advised that this situation be avoided. And it was actually from a guy in the SS who they noticed it when they would open the boxcars in the daytime or under lights, the victims would become angry, restless. They were more active. So this is a beautiful early example of somebody using language to, I think actually it's not even so much that they lack courage, but they know, you know, if you say, I killed him, sometimes you can't say those words, but if you say, with my cooperation, he ceased to exist, somehow that's actually physically easier to say. So I think that's a really interesting thing. And again, for me, it's not so much, I mean, it is, I guess, political or moral ethical, but the writer's job is to, you know, to come up with some language that has energy, that invigorates the reader. And part of the job is to sort of find out, well, what kind of language can I produce that invigorates? And I think during that period of discovery, you're sort of turning off your intentionality. You know, I didn't really want to be this kind of writer. I didn't really want to be a dark writer, or I didn't actually want to be a funny writer. But having tried other things that were more palatable to me and having them not have any energy, you're sort of like, well, I think sometimes it's like if a person wanted to write string quartets, but their string quartets kind of sucked, But when they played polka on the accordion, people danced. Then you sort of have to wake up and go, guess what? You're an accordion player. You know, it's that kind of, I think art often leads us to that kind of a crossroads.
But you mention, again, the dark and the funny. And that's the thing about your work. You do mix the two very, very well.
Yeah,
and, but how do you do that? I mean, it's not a conscious thing, is it?
No, it's just I think it's actually just some kind of neurological thing. You know, personally, I do it all the time. If I get nervous, I make a joke. And also my mind inclines toward the kind of worst case scenario, mainly because I think it's truthful. You know, in other words, to say, you know, we're here on this earth, but we're not here forever. And that each of us will die. It's such a kind of strange thing. And I remember even as a kid being kind of obsessed with that idea. So I think what has happened with me is that some natural tendencies where I don't really see dark and funny as being in opposition at all. I think they're the same thing. But it took me many years of work to kind of go, oh yeah, that's what I believe, you know. And that strangely corresponds with the thing that makes your prose energetic, you know. So I love the process of discovery that writing entails, because you really don't know who you are. At least I don't know who I am until I write and write and write and revise and revise. And then someday you look down and read draft 900 and go, oh, that's what I believe. You know, that's the best representation of my mindset that I've ever had, even better than the one that I can summon up at will. You know?
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with short story writer George Saunders. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is acclaimed short story writer George Saunders, whose latest book, 10th of December, is now available in paperback. George, to give the audience a sense of how you write, I'd like you to read a very short story from your new collection. It's called Styx.
Sure.
Could you just read it?
You bet. Every year, Thanksgiving night, we flocked out behind Dad as he dragged the Santa suit to the road and draped it over a kind of crucifix he'd built out of metal pole in the yard. Super Bowl week, the pole was dressed in a jersey and Rod's helmet, and Rod had to clear it with Dad if he wanted to take the helmet off. On 4th of July, the pole was Uncle Sam. On Veterans Day, a soldier. On Halloween, a ghost. The pole was Dad's one concession to glee. We were allowed a single Crayola from the box at a time. One Christmas Eve, he shrieked at Kimmy for wasting an apple slice. He hovered over us as we poured ketchup, saying, "Good enough, good enough, good enough." Birthday parties consisted of cupcakes, no ice cream. The first time I brought a date over, she said, "What's with your dad and that pole?" And I sat there blinking. We left home, married, had children of our own, found the seeds of meanness blooming also within us. Dad began dressing the pole with more complexity and less discernible logic. He draped some kind of fur over it on Groundhog Day and lugged out a floodlight to ensure a shadow. When an earthquake struck Chile, he laid the pole on its side and spray-painted a rift in the earth. Mom died, and he dressed the pole as death and hung from the crossbar photos of Mom as a baby. We'd stop by and find odd talismans from his youth arranged around the base. Army medals, theater tickets, old sweatshirts, tubes of Mom's makeup. One autumn, he painted the pole bright yellow. He covered it with cotton swabs that winter for warmth and provided offspring by hammering in six cross sticks around the yard. He ran lengths of string between the pole and the sticks and taped to the string letters of apology, admissions of error, pleas for understanding, all written in a frantic hand on index cards. He painted a sign saying, "Love," and hung it from the pole, and another that said, "Forgive." And then he died in the hall with the radio on, and we sold the house to a young couple who yanked out the pole and left it by the road on garbage day.
Okay, that story is only about 2 pages long, and yet I think it really encapsulates your style, because it's an outrageous premise. You have this man who's doing this thing with this pole. It's kind of funny in certain parts, but it does have this very sad quality to it. because it's like that song, Cat in the Cradle. Mm-hmm. This is a man who was not a very good father, and then toward the end of his life, perhaps tried to make amends, but it was too late. Mm. But you did it all with the pole.
Right.
How did you come up with that story?
I actually wrote this in 1994, while I was writing my first book. And I think what I remember of it was we were leaving church one day with our kids, and this was up in upstate New York, and a guy had a crucifix-shaped pole in his yard that was dressed in a Buffalo Bills jersey, had a football helmet on, and I thought, well, that's weird, and probably just did it for the game. But then next week I came back and it was naked, the pole was there. So it seemed he kept it up all the time. And I guess I first, so that just sort of stuck in my mind, and then the first idea of it was that he was going to be, I felt a little intimidated by him, actually, because whoever this guy was, he had enough time to do this, and he had the wherewithal to kind of make this kind of fun thing. So I started to write a story about that, and then I just reversed it at some point. I just thought, well, what if I didn't think anything. It was just more interesting to me if this poll was not exactly a great thing. And I think I just wrote it in an afternoon or a couple hours at work. I don't remember much about it. But to me, that's the beautiful thing about fiction is you start with some idea that probably is in your control. It's reducible. And then as you start adding sentences to it and trying to steer in the direction of maximum energy, the story will go off in directions that you never intended. And then you sort of assimilate the new direction, keep going after it. And then I remember ending this and just going with that phrase garbage day and just going, oh, okay, I did not plan for that to happen.
No. We're speaking with George Saunders, whose new book is 10th of December. There are two stories in your collection that, well, almost all the stories impressed me, but two of them really stood out for me. Escape from Spiderhead and the Semplica, I don't know if I'm pronouncing
it. I don't know either. Semplica, I think.
Semplica Girl Diaries. Let's look at Escape from Spiderhead for a moment, okay. Because in that story, again, both of them deal with oppression. Mm-hmm. They deal with people who are treated very badly by a system. Mm-hmm. In one case, Escape from Spiderhead, we have a prisoner who has become a guinea pig in some sort of experimental facility. Mm-hmm. And he's being given these drugs. And in other cases, Semplica Girl Diaries, it's even more of a horrible situation. You have these immigrant women from other countries, poor women, who are being used as lawn ornaments by wealthy people.
You say it that way, it sounds so depressing.
Well, yes, well, okay. They're being hung aloft with clotheslines through their heads.
Yes.
As if they're lawn ornaments.
Right, right. Almost like paper dolls.
Dolls, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And so, okay, so Escape from Spiderhead, talk about that for a moment.
Okay. All I really remember about the beginning of that one was that I have a kind of default voice that I'll write in it that's maybe, 10% less articulate than I might be in person, and just sort of a comic device. And I just was getting tired of it. So I wanted an excuse to write in some kind of exalted 19th century diction just because I wanted to do it. So I wrote a section where a character transitions from my normal voice up into that higher one. I liked it, but I didn't know why. And I thought, okay, well, it's a drug. Really just a cheap mechanical device. And again, as I said earlier, the main reason was to keep me interested in it and to make the prose have energy. So, but then once you say that, there's a drug in the world that can make a person more articulate, then that opens a doorway on a whole other world, which is, well, what else do they have? What other drugs? Why is he taking that drug? Is it his choice or someone else's? So often, if you can just get a little interesting thing at the beginning, the rest of the job is to keep opening doors in that universe and saying, oh, he's a prisoner. What did he do? What are the limits of these experiments that they can do? What are the goals of those experiments? And I guess that's what they would call the MacGuffin, just sort of the idea that gets you licensed to start exploring the world. And of course, in the course of doing something like that, politics come in and there's all kinds of themes and so on. But I've always felt that theme in a story or politics, they're kind of like very delicate forest animals that are there, but they're only going to come out of the woods if you don't stare at them, you know. So for me, the thing is to keep my attention on the mechanics of the story, especially in a sci-fi story. Make it viable, make it rich, make it very, very close to our world with just a slight turn. And then as you're doing your revision, you can feel the themes and subtext coming out, you know. But so that was really it. And I was sort of shocked to see where it went. And there were a couple moments, very brutal moments in there where I thought, oh no, I have to write that scene.
But yeah, it's really a story about torture as well.
Yeah. Inadvertent. I mean, again, not conscious.
Not conscious. You're right. Not conscious torture. But they notice they're torturing this person, or they're torturing these prisoners. They just don't realize they're torturing. Right. They don't accept the fact that they're
right.
torturing.
And again, the part of the fun of that, if you, in quotes, is that you get to run around to the other side of the table and say, okay, if I was the guy doing the torturing, how would I have to understand it in order to do it? And in that story, they couch it all in terms of human progress. But interestingly, you know, the best moment in the story is when your supposed bad guy starts talking sense. Like in that story, there's a drug that causes you basically to fall madly in love with the first thing that you see. And the boss makes a pretty good case for that as a war preventive drug. You know, if you could just, you've got a war going on, slip this into the water supply. So that's the fun of it. You don't really know where it's going, and when it sort of throws you for a loop, it's really enjoyable.
Well, drugs do play a big role in your fiction. I've noticed that. I mean, does that come from the, is that because your pharmaceutical background?
Or because I was a druggie as a kid? Sometimes I think, I'll tell you one reason I think it does is, and I'm not sure I can articulate this, but when I was a kid, I had a very powerful experience once. I had the flu or the measles or something, and I got a high fever. And I just remember being in my room, and the world transmogrified. Everything was miserable. You know how when you're sick, my room was stupid, my town was stupid, the clouds were dumb, everything was just horrible. And then, of course, I got better, and everything went back to being wonderful. And I just noted that the world hadn't changed a bit, but my perceiving apparatus had changed, which then changed the world. And I was always interested in that. You know, so in other words, if you meet a really optimistic person, I started to understand that person as being sort of chemically optimistic. You know, a person who's happy all the time has a certain brain chemistry that produces that. Likewise, a cynic or whatever. So I was never able to shake that idea. And in Spiderhead, I found myself thinking, oh, the drugs are just a sort of a metaphor for the natural pharmaceuticals that we're all on all the time. You know, you fall in love and suddenly your body chemistry changes and you can't eat and, you know, so on. So.
Well, Martin Amis has said that in the past we worshipped these gods named Thor, Apollo, Zeus. Now we have these drugs that sound like the names of gods.
Yeah. Yeah.
Paxil, Prozac, Viagra.
Right.
They do sound like ancient gods.
Yeah. But you know, I love the idea that those pharmaceutical gods are active even in a non-medicated person. You know, I heard something once about love drugs, you know, that your body actually secretes different chemicals when you're in a long-term relationship and short-term, which is, you know, very interesting.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with short story writer George Saunders. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is short story writer George Saunders, whose latest collection is called 10th of December. George, in the last segment, I brought up the Semplica Girl Diaries, another story in the collection. And we talked about how that was about immigrant women who were being used as lawn ornaments by wealthy people, you know, with a clothesline through their head as they were hanging above. And this was a status symbol.
Right.
This is something that people like, because if they get it, that means that they've made it.
Right.
So that was a crazy idea. Where you get that from?
A dream. I've had maybe three or four stories in my life that came out of dream, and that was one. I dreamed that the person I was in the dream went to this window and looked out in the backyard, and there were these five women that I understood in the dream to be from impoverished countries, and they had on beautiful long white smocks, and they all had long black hair, and these wires went right through their temples, you know, on the side, and they weren't in pain and they weren't unhappy, and they were kind of quietly chatting in the moonlight. So that was weird enough. But then in the dream, and the thing that made me want to write it was the person I was in the dream wasn't horrified or appalled. He was deeply satisfied, deeply happy. He had that feeling like, wow, I'm so fortunate to be able to do this for my kids. and the sense that they had been suffering because they didn't have these things. So that, you know, I mean, 90% of the dreams you have, you wake up and you realize they're nonsense. But that one really stuck with me. And, you know, it was...
And the story is told from the point of view of a man who doesn't own those
right.
those ornaments. He's middle class, working class.
Right.
But he aspires to have
right. he can't
that.
Afford,
so
he can't
so he's
afford
looking
it.
At those things and other... He drives around looking at those rich people's... Lawrence, I wish I had that.
Right, right. And then I won't give it away, but he comes into some money.
Yeah.
So that was just one of those ideas that you know, sometimes when you're lucky, you get an idea that confounds you a little bit. That one I thought, oh, what the heck? What kind of world is that? Why is he not appalled? And that's a great gift because then you get to, through working on the story, figure out the mechanics of the world. And that was a 14-year project. It was so difficult because on the first level, I could see when I woke up that it's a story, quote unquote, about, you know, immigration or about inequity.
Yeah.
But in the short story aesthetic, if that's all it was, then it's just a screed and you don't need it. So one of the things that I liked, and I didn't intend it, but he's quite a likable guy. He's basically me. I was using my own diaries at times to, you know, so he's a reasonable guy who has, I think, a very admirable love of his family. And maybe his slight mistake is that he thinks the way to show his love is to ensure a certain level of material prosperity. And he's just got a blind spot, as does the rest of the culture, about these girls. So it was interesting, though, to kind of try to make it rich enough that it wouldn't just be a diatribe, but it would actually be a sort of an opposition of different forces.
Well, another story, because again, you are not a political writer, but I do see politics in your stories.
Yeah.
Another story was Puppy. Mm-hmm. And for me, what I liked about that story was, at least what I saw, was a kind of satire of the liberal sensibility. Because, just to set up what that story is about, it's about two women. One is an upper class, fairly cultured, affluent woman with a pretty nice life, mm-hmm. with a very liberal, progressive point of view.
Right.
The other is a woman who's very working class, very struggling very hard, has a boy with some problems, behavioral problems, perhaps even, you know, mental problems. Mm-hmm. And they meet because the upper class woman wants to buy a puppy from the lower class woman.
Right.
And what I saw in that story was a wonderful clash of cultures, of class consciousness, how sometimes someone from one class sees something in another class and then passes judgment on it without having all the information. So
right. Well, that's true. And one of the complicating things is that the upper class woman came from very modest circumstances herself. I think that's a good reading. You know, one of the interesting about that story was I had sent an early draft of it to the New Yorker and they rejected it. And Deborah Treisman, who's just a brilliant editor, said that in that draft I had... I was sort of, how would I say it? The working class woman had a lot of dialect going on. Her speech was much rougher than it was in the final one. And she felt that I was kicking that character a bit, which I kind of was. I was sort of having a lot of fun that sounded like I was having it at her expense. So I revised her up a little bit. So I just took out about half of her mistakes, you know, just left enough of her... dictional weirdness to indicate class. And then it seemed like the story sort of stood up all of a sudden. I mean, suddenly it was a more of a fair fight. But I thought that your reading is correct. Although I also think, you know, I wouldn't mind if it was also interpreted as a bit of a satire on the lower class woman because she also makes some kind of crazy decisions. I think my heart goes to her a little bit because she's in a bit of a cage. You know?
She's having a rough time.
Yeah. But I think, you know, in story dynamics, what's really wonderful is when you can sort of get a world going where both sides are right and both sides are wrong. I sometimes imagine it as two walls just exactly balanced against each other. You know, so you can sort of say, I can see it from this person's point of view. I can run around to the other side of the table and see it from that person's point of view. And when you look to the author to say who's right, the author's gone. You know, that actually the idea is that, like Chekhov said, you know, art doesn't have to solve problems, but it has to formulate them correctly.
Yeah. Has to raise questions.
Yeah, yeah.
We're speaking with George Saunders, whose new book is 10th of December. I Well, bringing up class, I have to bring up perhaps one of your greatest short stories, which is not in this collection. It's in another collection. It's called Sea Oak. And Sea Oak has been widely anthologized. It is a classic example of what H.P. Lovecraft called the weird tale. But it's a weird tale with a socioeconomic undertone. This is a story of a very extremely working class family. Like, we're talking out of like TV Shameless.
Yeah, I'm not that sure they're even working. They're just
they're not even working. Yeah. The narrator works at a Chippendales like strip club, and he comes from the poorest of the poor family, dysfunctional poor. And what happens is this is it an aunt?
Yeah.
An aunt who has been living with them and is taking care of them and is a perennial victim, a lifelong victim. Mm-hmm. She dies. And then she comes back as a zombie, basically. But a telepathic zombie who then directs orders to the family in order to improve their lives. She wants to improve their lives. She really wants to help them.
Right.
But the advice she gives them is rather, how can we put it, outrageous.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a. I've taught that story to my students, and they respond very well to it. Where did that story come from?
I can tell you. We were living up in Syracuse, and I was at the mall one day, and I was walking behind these two teenage girls, and they were having this crazy conversation that was almost all in swear words, no verbs, just da 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 da. And I was so fascinated, I kind of started stalking them, just followed them around. And then when I went home, I just drafted up a model, sort of a highly stylized model of their conversation, and it really was fun. I could do it, which is scary. And again, it was this idea of kind of weird poetics. There was a beautiful kind of telegraphic quality in their invented conversation. So sometimes I'll just start a story that way, have a little bit of text, maybe a third of a page. I don't know who's saying it. I don't know where it's from, but I like the energy. And then you just keep going back to it and find out who the people are. Where do they live? In the course of this dialogue, this aunt was created. You know, she appeared. So then you just kind of nurse the story along. And so pretty soon I had a pretty funny, pretty tight vignette in which this family existed and then the aunt died. So that was good. And then I got stuck for about 4 years. I couldn't figure out what was supposed to happen next. It seemed like the most interesting character was gone. It started to become a bit like an after school special. Can they get out of the bad housing complex? And I was really frustrated because I liked what I had, but it was dead in the water. So we went on vacation and I came back to it and I was just kind of thinking about it. And I thought, I know that aunt has to come back. So I had a period of writing her into dream sequences where she tries to ID her killer, flashbacks, the whole, all cheesy. So I said, again, I know she has to come back. And just as if, I don't even know how to explain it, the phrase back from the dead popped into my head, literally just popped in my head. And suddenly, you know, as a kid who watched a lot of Night Gallery and Twilight Zone, I went, oh, I get that story. And then came in and finished it pretty quickly. So I think one of the strengths of the story is I really genuinely didn't know that's where it was going until it went there. And then it just, I don't know, it had a lot in there that spoke to me, a lot of things that...
It deals a lot with consumerism. It deals a lot with, again, class. Mm-hmm. Because here's a family that's trying to get out of its rut.
Right.
Economic rut.
But it's also a family that's causing its rut. You know, it's sort of a very dysfunctional, as you said. But again, you know, it's interesting because I am kind of a political writer, I whether I want to be or not. But also, I have to always remind myself that a story doesn't earn a reader's affection by being political, and not even by being politically accurate, but it can do that, but it has to be something else on top. It has to have a flair on top of that. So what I found myself loving in that story was, for example, those two sisters, the way they speak is really enjoyable. You know, the aunt comes back with some pretty good speeches. So hopefully it's fun as well as, you know, everything else.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with George Saunders. This is Ariel Gonzalez. You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLIN. Welcome back. This is Eric Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is George Saunders, who has been called one of the best short story writers in America. And his latest book is called 10th of December, and it's now available in paperback. George, another story that's not in this collection I want to talk about is The Red Bow. It's in your collection, I think, called In Persuasion Nation. And I really like that story because it also has a science fiction undertone to it. This is a story of a plague that erupts in a community. These dogs become violent, rabid, and they assault people, kill them. And these dogs have killed this little girl. And the story is told from the point of view of the father. And they've ripped her to shreds, though you never see it. Mm. You see it after the fact. You never show us what happens after the fact. And the red bow is the thing that he has left from her. That, you know, the one thing that he's kept from her. And the family's destroyed. But an uncle uses the tragedy to try to take control of the community, in essence. To me, and maybe I'm stretching, and please, you know, tell me if I'm wrong, it was a kind of almost like a 9/11 story.
Yeah.
Because to me, it was a metaphor for what happens in tragedies when something bad happens and then people exploit it, take advantage of it for political gain.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. I almost never would do this, but at that point, I think we had just invaded Iraq and I was really frustrated and I felt frustrated by what we were doing and also by the kind of crazy public discourse around it. So I thought, for once in my life, I'm going to try to make a direct metaphor for what's going on. Also because I think at this time, it was during that period where we had invaded and, you know, liberals like me were waiting to see if they would find WMD. And then, of course, we didn't. But that sort of strange period where I felt like this is a really aggressive thing to do. I'm pretty sure it's wrong, but, you know, I don't have enough information. So I just kind of made it originally as a sort of a scale model, an attempted scale model of the situation as well as I knew it, just to sort of see what would work out on the page. And then, of course, your job is to forget that and treat them as real people. But in this story, one of the things is that the uncle is sort of an opportunist, and he falls into all this cheap rhetoric, sentimentalizing the girl. And then the conclusion that they draw is sort of like, I guess, during the McCarthy era and also during post 9/11, where, you know, since a dog killed a girl, we are a little suspicious of cats as well, and we're not that crazy about goldfish. So since we honor the memory of this beloved departed, let's err on the side of completion and kill all the animals. And if you don't like it, you must be a dog.
There's something wrong with you.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, it's funny. I just read Arthur Miller's memoir, and that is exactly the mindset in the 50s. I think it's a human mindset, but maybe a particularly American mindset that I think isn't, you know, we're not cured of it yet.
Well, there was a Twilight Zone episode of it, the Monsters of Maple Street.
Oh, I don't know if I saw that.
Okay, the Monsters of Maple Street, which was written by Rod Serling, and he did it with the McCarthyist period in mind. These in this neighborhood, these strange things are happening, and the people start to wonder if there's an alien amongst them. So they start going after each other. And at the end, they really, you know, the entire community is ripped apart.
Right.
And then what you see is that these aliens have manipulated all this.
Oh.
That they're watching this from afar, saying that's all we need to do. We just need to have them go after each other, make them paranoid, and then they do all the rest of the war.
It wasn't Rod Serling an amazing writer when you think about it?
Huh? Yeah.
He's a Syracuse guy.
Okay. Well, George, one thing I'd like to bring up is, because you mentioned Iraq, is your story Home in the new collection. And this is about a returning veteran. You never mention Iraq in the story. You never mention Afghanistan, but clearly he's been fighting one of those wars. Right. And apparently he committed some sort of atrocity. Again, that's never specific, it's never clear. And he returns home. And clearly this is a story that, unfortunately, something that a lot of veterans have to deal with. What was running through your mind when you were?
You know, at some point I was trying to rectify my bad education, and I read Heracles, the play by Euripides. And I had read it and I thought, oh my God, that would be an incredible play if we updated it into the contemporary era. And then I forgot about that. And two or three years later thought, I'll try it as a story. And in the meantime, I sort of misremembered the plot. So this was sort of a retelling of that story of a guy who goes to hell, you know, goes to the underworld, comes back. And what I loved about Heracles was that in the play, he comes back. A king has been taking advantage of his family, about to evict them and kill his children. And Heracles kills the king, but because of where he's been, he also goes nuts and kills his family. And I thought that was one of the, you know, if you think about the cost of violence, it's not only if you encourage someone to learn the craft of violence and to execute, well, the victims certainly suffer, but then that person has also been transformed, and it's sort of a live wire then. You don't know where it's gonna, you know, what it's gonna hit next. So I think that was, I'm sure that that's something we're gonna be dealing with for many years, that we took a generation of young people and said, go forth and learn that craft. And then they, you know, you come back changed. I'm sure you must. So that was the start of it.
And we tell, we have this little cliche, thank you for your service, right. Thank you for your service, which in the story, people keep saying
they
to
keep
this
saying it to
soldier.
Him.
They keep saying, thank you for your service, but they don't really mean it.
No.
It's just something.
It's just a way of saying, move on.
Move on.
Yeah.
And we don't want to talk, but notice, we don't talk about Iraq anymore.
Right. I think, for me, this phase of life, it strikes me really strongly that we are drifting from some basic fundamental truths about love and gentleness and nonviolence and compassion. And we're doing it with some kind of, it feels to me like a corporate overlay. So we have wars, which we sort of contract out to a volunteer army and to contractors, an incredible system of explaining these wars away through pragmatism and so on. And I think what's neglected is a human being is basically a peace-craving object. We want to be loved. We want to be left in peace. You take a person like that, send them out there and tell them to do these things, and then expect them to come back unaltered is just ridiculous. So the story, you know, again, that's where it started from. And then, you know, along the way, it became funny and it became, there's verbal play and all that kind of stuff. But
We're speaking with short story writer George Saunders, whose new book is 10th of December. I was surprised to find out that you were once an Ayn Rand man. In fact, you have this funny piece in New Yorker where you claim to be Ayn Rand's lover.
Yes. A dark episode.
A dark episode in your life. there's a rape joke in there, but I won't say it. But why? How did an Ayn Rand man become an extremely compassionate and moral writer, as you are?
Well, I found her work when I was in high school, and reading it is the reason I went to college. I hadn't read much fiction, and Atlas Shrugged were just a mind blower. I loved that it was so long, and there were characters, and you know. So mostly on the power of that reading experience, I started applying to colleges, and so then I was sort of a young Republican, went out to the School of Mines in Colorado, which is sort of an engineering, great engineering school. And I think, you know, I was from a family, a Democratic family, a Chicago South Side sort of working family. And I think I liked her because she told me what every young man wants to hear, which is just do what you want. Do what you want. Anyone who tells you differently or tries to shape you or change you is wrong. At least that's what I heard her saying. And then when I went, I got a degree in geophysics, went to Asia and worked in the oil fields. And it was an incredible immersion experience in all kinds of stuff, suffering, you know, all kinds of poor people. And our company, we were sort of oppressing people all over the place. We were exploring for oil, tromping through tropical rainforests and so on. So somehow that 2 years being overseas gradually beat the objectivism out of me. And I could see that there were people all over the place suffering, not because they caused it or not because they didn't try or because they were, you know, whiners, but because the world is difficult. And, you know, so by the time I got home, I was sort of repoliticized.
Well, thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with George Saunders.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. You can also see his reviews and blog on the Huffington Post. So thanks for tuning in. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's wlrn.org. More information, including author and book links, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like, if you will. Tomorrow's program is with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Julia Angwin. She's written Dragnet Nation, which looks critically at increases in government surveillance. Try as she may, she could not hide her identity. And the calendar. On this day in 1882, 132 years ago, the death of poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow in Cambridge, Massachusetts. His works include Hiawatha and The Courtship of Miles Standish. And on this day in 1930, 84 years ago, the birth of actor Steve McQueen in Beech Grove, Indiana, the king of cool. Of course, he made The Great Escape, Bullet and Papillon. In 1974, he was the world's highest paid actor. McQueen was a World War II Marine. He died in 1980 at age 50. And one more while we ruminate on censorship. On this day in 1960, 54 years ago, a U.S. appeals court ruled D.H. Lawrence's novel, Lady Chatterley's Lover, not obscene. It was written in 1928 and considered pornographic by some. Mainly by those who hadn't read it. So we leave with a thought from D.H. Lawrence, who died in Venice, France, in 1930, only 44. Quote, ethics and equity and the principles of justice do not change with the calendar. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, returns tomorrow. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.